Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, let's talk this show about what's been the result of the one full year of the COVID recession here. Who gained? Who lost? You know, previous shows, we've done a little bit of analysis of GDP numbers and job numbers. Most recent here, June, July, inflation. In other words, classic economic indicators. But who's benefited? You know, how did the distribution of all these bailout programs go? Who really made out? And who took it in the neck? Let's look at some of those real indicators of who benefited and who didn't. Okay, you know, in the news you hear a lot about U.S. billionaires, and one interesting indicator is U.S. billionaires added over $1 trillion to their wealth. Over $1 trillion. A lot of that's due to the stock market continuing to boom through this whole process, through the whole past year. You know, the crisis really begins in late February, early March. The economy begins to feel the pressure from COVID. It was already slipping in that direction significantly at the end of 2019. COVID just pushed it over the cliff big time. COVID precipitated the crisis and helped exacerbate it through the shutdowns. But the economy was already in trouble and probably would have drifted towards a mild recession anyway in the following year, 2020 or 2021. But COVID pushed it over the cliff and exacerbated both the depth and the rate of the collapse. In the first 4 months of 2020, well, not four months, from February on, the economy contracted 10.3% over the previous period, not year over year, annualized, over the previous period, which is the better indicator. And then in the third quarter, the summer of 2020, it recovered partially, and I think it grew like 7.4% in GDP terms. But then in the fourth quarter, it lapsed again, and GDP grew only 1.1%. So we had a classic, what I call epic recession trajectory here, where you have a big crash, you have a partial recovery, you have a relapse, it slows down again. Sometimes the slowdown can be negative, like in Europe, it turned into a negative GDP. And then you have a recovery once again, and that peters out. And you're sort of bouncing along the bottom, W shape, over a long term, 5 to 7 years. That's a great recession trajectory. And we are on track for that kind of trajectory here in the early phases. You know, it's only been 18 months, but that's the broad numbers of what's going on. But you know, within that trajectory, who's benefited and who's lost? Well, the billionaires, we know, U.S. billionaires added $1 trillion to their wealth because the stock market just kept booming. Well, why did the stock market just keep booming? Well, because the Federal Reserve, the central bank, pumped in almost $4 trillion into the banks, who then loan it to other companies and investors, and they themselves invest that money. And when you've got all these people laid off, they're not buying goods and services, especially services, right? Well, what are they going to do with all that money, the bankers and investors? Well, they're going to put it in financial asset markets, and they flowed, the money flowed into stocks and bonds and other securities. And that's what happened Well, that enriched the billionaires and all the other investors tremendously. That is the conduit, you know, the Federal Reserve, free money. When Federal Reserve throws all that money in, the free money lowers interest rates. And when interest rates are so low, what do businesses do, especially medium and large businesses? They issue corporate bonds and raise cash. And data shows that they raised over the course of 2020, you know, $1 to $2 trillion in cash by issuing corporate bonds, which were real cheap in terms of what the companies had to pay in terms of interest to whoever bought their corporate bonds. And, of course, they borrowed down their credit lines from big banks non-bank companies did as a further, buffer in case they needed it. And a lot of them really cut their costs tremendously, facilities costs, even wages here. And that added more money to their coffers as well. Well, you know, all of that, what are they going to do with all that extra money they're saving and getting? They, meaning corporations, well, you know, their finance departments are going to put that money somewhere. Where do they put it? They put it in financial assets, in the stock market. In other words, the bailout of investors and the bailout of corporations and pre-bailout of the banks, because the banks weren't really in trouble. You know, the Federal Reserve is responsible for that. All that free money, lowering interest rates and issuing corporate bonds as a consequence and so forth. Right, tremendous amount, trillions of dollars of cash accumulated, and they put it into the stock market and other financial asset markets as well, buying currencies, you know, derivatives, all that stuff. That's what they do with it. Trillions and trillions of dollars flowing into securities, and that raises the wealth. As the prices go up, all that money flowing into those markets, the demand increases, demand drives up the price, and the appreciation of the stocks, stock values and bond values, you know, creates that $1 trillion for the billionaires. And, of course, there's trillions, cumulative trillions for all the multimillionaires below the billionaires, right? So a big boondoggle. From the bailout that wasn't needed for large corporations. You know, the government, when they passed, the federal government, when they passed the CARES Act back in March 2020, the first stimulus, they provided $1.1 trillion in loans for medium and large corporations. $1.1 trillion. But they never took the loans. They didn't need it. They were fat with cash for these other reasons I just explained. And, you know, the unclaimed loans just sat there. And the Fed had to give the money back to the Treasury at the end of last year. Yeah, so, you know, they didn't need to be bailed out. Corporate America didn't need to be bailed out. You know, there are a few exceptions, you know, the airline companies and the hotels and so forth. But that's a sliver compared to all the rest. Now, they got bailed out. They accumulated all that cash. They threw it into stock markets, stocks and bonds, and made themselves even more wealthy. Right? Some data just came out last week that also showed that in terms of their revenue, not just what they got from raising bonds, corporate bonds, or from the government or whatever, but their revenue from sales over the past year kind of hit a record as well. Data just came out here last week that for the Fortune 500 companies reporting their numbers here over the year, for the second quarter of this year, right, compared to the second quarter of last year, 2020, you know, the second quarter of last year was when the big collapse occurred. All right. And this year, second quarter 2021, we got the reopening and the rebound. 89% of the Fortune 500 companies increased their revenue flow over this year of the pandemic, from second quarter 2020 to the second quarter June here of 2021, increased their revenue by 24.7%. Second quarter revenue 25% higher than the same quarter, second quarter 2020. That compares to average quarterly revenue growth, you know, over the previous 5 years when there was no recession, of 4.5%. And over the previous 10 years, 3.4%. So 25% in the past year compared to an average revenue gain for Fortune 500 of 4.5% or 3.4%. Well, that big revenue gain brings in, cash from revenue, profits from revenue. On top of issuing all that corporate bonds and raising trillions and other ways they raise cash. So corporate America, especially the Fortune 500 companies, are awash with trillions of dollars of cash. Awash. What are you going to do with that? They don't let it sit there. You know, they're paying their VPs of finance big bucks to earn on all that cash. Well, it goes into stock markets, primarily in bond markets and currency markets. You know, they speculate in currencies, oil futures, commodity futures, derivatives of all kind. You know, that's what they do. That's what they did. That's what they're doing. And that's why you got investors, you know, and corporations raking in the big bucks on the back of this crisis. Big bucks. A lot of it made possible by the Federal Reserve, you see, providing free money to these folks, driving down interest rates, allowing them to, you know, sell their bonds, take out their low interest loans. And by the way, I predict, what are they going to do with that starting this year? You know, well, they'll continue throwing in financial markets, but they're also going to resume providing big payments and stock buybacks and dividend payouts. You know, under Trump, in the first 3 years under Trump before we had the crash 2020, they were averaging $1.2, $1.3 trillion in distributions, corporations distributing part of this, the cash, you know, that they were rake in, $1.3 trillion a year, every year, to the shareholders. Well, no wonder the 1% and the 1/10th and 1/100th of the 1% are getting so wealthy. And, of course, you know, when they give it to the shareholders, what do the shareholders do with it? Well, they roll it right back into the financial asset markets. Because they don't crash, you see. They don't crash. Or if they do, they recover very quickly because the Fed and the government, that's their priority. Make sure those markets keep going. That's the picture on the side of the those who enjoy capital incomes. Well, they've done quite well, continuing to do very, very well. What about the rest? What's the picture here? Who gained? Who lost? Okay, let's look at who lost. Well, who lost were workers and small businesses and renters and everybody else up to their elbows in debt. Well, what's the picture in terms of workers? 35 million American workers were at some point unemployed last year. Maybe the number is even higher. That was the peak in you know, the early months. There were 35 million, you know, shut down the economy. And some of them got their jobs back and others lost their jobs and so forth as the economy followed that trajectory. So at least 35 million found themselves unemployed at some time and may even be even larger, 50 million. Well, you know, if you're unemployed, you got no wages. You got lost wages. You got a big wage cut. Now, if you collected unemployment benefits, it offset a little bit of that. But unemployment benefits are never designed to fully offset your lost wages. You know, at most, maybe a fifth or a fourth. So, you know, all the unemployed lost income, right? And today, we still have 17 million people jobless. You hear a lot about, oh, 8.7 million jobs have been lost, and we need to recover those jobs. You know, this is the message that comes out of politicians and the mainstream media. 8.7 million are jobless. How can that be when you got 12 million people collecting unemployment benefits and you got 3 million people that dropped out of the labor force, not collecting any benefits? You know, add some more for people who have been thrown off of the unemployment benefits rolls here in, you know, 20-some states in the South and Midwest. Add them. They're not even registered as collecting benefits because they can't collect them anymore. I don't know what that number is, but we're talking about millions that have been thrown out here in recent months. And then add 1.5 million people who are improperly classified as working when they're not working by the Labor Department. Yeah, 1.5 million. Because of the way the Labor Department asks questions doing their survey of unemployment here starting in March 2020. Yeah. If you were furloughed by your company and you were at home and you weren't getting paid, but you expected to be returned, you were temporarily shut down and furloughed, the government said, oh, you were employed. Wait a minute, you're not getting paid anything, but you're employed because you expect to be returned. Yeah, so, you know, add that 1.5 million, add 3 million dropout, add 12 to 14 million, officially 12, collecting benefits. You got 17 million people still. Yeah, now COVID Delta is looming large, isn't it? Looming large. People are getting nervous, rightfully so. Yeah. So, you know, the average worker, particularly workers in low-paid service jobs, and especially in those industries hard hit, you know, travel, entertainment, leisure, hospitality, and so forth, aren't doing so well, did not do so well, notwithstanding a partial offset with some unemployment benefits and some checks. Doesn't add up. They definitely went backwards, are going backwards. Contrast that to corporations and investors and billionaires. A tale of two bailouts here, tale of two recoveries, right? And, you know, people going back for jobs now, there's this big issue. Oh, they're not taking the jobs. There's 10 million job openings and only 8.7 million unemployed. Well, it's not 8.7 million, it's 17 million. But okay, the mainstream media is saying 8.7 million and 10 million openings. Why do, well, 8.7 is less than 10. Why won't those folks just take those 10 million jobs? Because they're mismatched, you see. A lot of the 10 million jobs are jobs for people for skills that the unemployed, being largely service workers, don't have. They're mismatched. They couldn't take them. They couldn't qualify for them if they wanted them. A lot of those jobs, skilled jobs, you know, not just in tech, you know, or STEM occupations, But construction work, manufacturing, welders, and so forth, we don't have enough of them anymore. Why? Because U.S. corporations abandoned in-job training. They got rid of it. Why did they get rid of it? Well, because they moved up the manufacturing offshore. That's why they got rid of it. Or new technologies enable them to do with fewer workers, so they don't train them. You know, this country used to have a wonderful business in-house training programs, you know, in the 60s and 70s, even early 80s, where we would train people. And the government had a job training program. But when we started moving corporations offshore, they say, we don't need to do that. Or if we really need, like in tech, we'll just bring some foreign skilled people into the country. You know, under Clinton, 500,000 a year coming into tech and other occupations. Yeah. And these alternative sources and causes meant that we're not going to do job training. And the government didn't step in and do it either. And that's why we have shortages. Even in construction, we don't have enough skilled people to take the jobs in construction. And, of course, more skilled in manufacturing, you know, running software machines and robots and so forth, right? Takes more skill than, you know, just putting a rearview mirror, you know, screwing it into the car. They don't do those things anymore. And then a lot of service jobs are more skilled too. Anyway, that's one of the reasons we have this mismatch between 10 million and 8.7 million, which isn't really 8.7 million. Yeah. Well, this is the way, you know, the government cherry picks certain data statistic points and pumps them through the media to make it look like the situation is better than it is. They do that with inflation, too. Right? Inflation is much worse than they're reporting. It's because of the assumptions they make when they estimate prices in these inflation indexes, be it the CPI or the PCE. You know, it's the assumptions, what they include and how they include them. It makes the inflation look less than it actually is. Why did they do that? Because if it were higher, if inflation were greater, then the GDP would be much lower, real GDP, because you adjust GDP, gross domestic product, by the rate of inflation. So if the rate of inflation is higher, the real result is lower. We don't want that to be too high, right? Just like they misreport often by select statistics for the unemployment rate. You know, it's supposed to be, what, 5.9, 5.7%? Nonsense. It's over 10%. Nonsense. Because when they say, 5.4%, they're only talking about full-time workers. They're not talking about part-time or temp or discouraged or missing part of the missing labor force. And even that isn't the full picture. What they have a hard time resolving is the fact you got so many people, so many more people collecting unemployment benefits than you're reporting as unemployed. And boy, you don't get unemployment benefits unless you're unemployed. And many who are unemployed don't even get the benefits. Yeah. So, you know, when I say 17 million, that's government statistics, just as the 8.7 million is. But the media and the politicians, you know, like to cherry pick, you know, partial data to make the situation look and get people to believe the situation is better than it actually is. Okay. A lot of workers not going back to work. What's behind that? I think, you know, part of it is they can't find affordable child care. Part of it is the schools were closed. Now they're reopening. Part of it has to do with a lot of service workers who've been buffeted here, you know, laid off, recalled for a while, laid off again, you know, shut down this and opening and shut down this. I'm just saying I have had enough I'm going to get some other kind of work that's more stable. There's some of that going on. But I think, too, it's that companies are calling people back in the service industries for fewer hours of work. Companies are just testing the waters with this reopening, and they're you know, bringing people back, offering their jobs back at fewer hours. Well, that means less weekly pay. You see, weekly earnings are your hourly wage times the number of hours you work. That's your weekly earnings. You can offer people a bonus to return of $500 or $1,000 even, right? But you make it up by giving them fewer hours of work because you're not sure how much consumer demand will be out there. You know, you're not going to just open everything big guns like you were, it was 2019, if you're a service business. You know, you're going to open it little by little and see how much demand you really have. Well, you know, they're offering people, in many cases, fewer hours of work. So workers aren't going to come back for fewer hours. You know? Oh, you hear, you know, the anecdotal evidence about bonuses to return to work and so forth. But the bonuses may not make up for the loss of hours of work. And, you know, workers can do that calculation pretty darn quick. Wait a minute, you know, my pay at the end of the week or the month is going to be less. You know, more of this instability. You know, do I really want to go back to that job? I better get in something, you know, more stable for a longer term. So, you know, I think part of the not going back to work has to do with lower hours being offered. When you add all this up, you know, fewer hours of work and the unemployment and the fact that in these service jobs, a lot of these businesses think they can continue offering $7.25 an hour, particularly in the red states, it creates a picture where wages have not really risen. Well, wait a minute. They're saying, they're reporting wages are up 3.9% over the year. Well, that's 3.9% on average for those, you know, who didn't get laid off, for those who didn't get shut down. Mm-hmm. You take away the very lowest pay, that's 7.25 or barely above that, and the average goes up, even though there's been no real wage increases. The average goes up. And that's what's involved. In other words, it's totally distorted. You know, the figure 3.9% overall wage gains is totally distorted by those who are, you know, higher paid, who didn't get laid off. Because it's really, you know, the COVID thing has really whacked low-paid service workers the worst. Contrast that to CEO pay that just came out here. Economic Policy Institute reported 350 CEOs, or Fortune 500 CEOs, are making an average last year of $24 million average, $24 million plus $70,000 in benefits on top of that. Benefits and pay make up what's called compensation. You know, you got your salary, your wage, and then you have the benefits, and together they're called the compensation. Well, CEO compensation in the U.S., went up 18.9% last year. Whoa, they gave themselves a nice raise, didn't they, throughout all of this? You know, their companies may be almost shut down, but they gave themselves a raise. Yeah. The CEOs in the U.S. Make today 351 times the pay of the average worker in their company, 351 times that pay. You know, so if the pay was $30,000, multiply that 351 times greater. In 1965, it was 21 times. So in the last half century, they've boosted their their share from 21 times the average paid worker in their company to 351 times the average paid worker in their company. And last year, 24 million. 24 million. Well, they did quite well, right? We can add them to the billionaires making their money from financial assets and stocks, you know, and to the corporations that increased their revenue 25%. You know, the picture's pretty rosy at the other end, at the capital incomes end. Not so rosy at the wage end. You know, not so rosy. In between that is, you know, the small businesses. Small businesses, you know, really, you know, you can define small business different ways. Some agencies say, oh, 500 or fewer employees. Some say 50 or fewer employees. You know, and then you have millions of, quote, small businesses with no employees, just a proprietor. Oftentimes, professionals get laid off, you see, in these crises, and they put up a shingle as a consultant, and they say, oh, you know, I'm not laid off. I'm in business. I'm a small business person, right? And then the Labor Department says, oh, okay. Okay, unincorporated small business. Okay, you're employed, not making any money, but they're employed because when they're interviewed, you know, by phone, they're simply asked, are you working? And they say, oh, yes, I started my own company. Oh, okay, good, we'll put you down. No more questions. Put you down as employed. Well, we got a lot of those unincorporated small businesses increasing in numbers, who are really professionals that got dumped, or managers, right, going, quote, in business for themselves, freelancers, whatever. Big growing part of the labor force. Right. Well, how did small businesses do over the course of this trajectory of year one of the COVID recession? They got a lot of bailout. They got a lot of bailout. You know, the total checks for non-businesses, the checks that went out to average workers here, you know, the relief checks and the unemployment benefits. I haven't done the final calculations yet, but it looks like, you know, workers got in unemployment benefits and checks somewhere between $500 billion and $700 billion over the past year. Well, how much did small businesses get? They got about $1 trillion. The initial CARES Act in March 2020, the first bailout, provided $350 billion. But that was gamed by a lot of companies that really didn't need it. You see, it made a big, big stink there, gaming the bailout. And they had to throw another $310 billion in pretty quick. So in the first half of last year, there was $660 billion. And that ran out in August. And a lot of companies fell through the cracks. A lot of small businesses went under because they couldn't get part of the bailout, or the bailout wasn't enough. Okay, so then the CARES Act bailout for small business expires in August of last year, and then we have more small businesses going under, especially when the third COVID wave hits in last winter, and they Congress quickly passed another bill called the Consolidated Appropriations Act at the end of December, because unemployment benefits were running out too. And that was another $325 billion for small businesses. So you got $660 billion, you know, in spring, summer of 2020, and then at the end of the year, you get another $325 billion for small businesses, and they continued unemployment benefits for a while further as well. That was about a $900 billion package, that Consolidated Appropriations Act, Emergency Cash Act is what it was really called, right? Get some more $300 checks out there to people real quick, or $600 checks to people real quick. Get it out there. Extend unemployment benefits that were running out, and give $325 billion more to small businesses. Well, that brings the total almost to $1 trillion in 2020 for small businesses in the form of, quote, loans that were easily converted to outright grants. You know, virtually all of this, they don't pay anything back. That's like their checks, you see, their relief checks, their unemployment benefits for small businesses. But then when Biden comes in office and passes the American Rescue Plan in early March, they provide even more for small businesses. From my calculations, it looks like about another $76 billion. They added some money to the coffer on the payroll protection plan for small businesses. They put another $15 billion into the disaster loan for small businesses program, right? Gave states another $10 billion to loan to small businesses, provided $29 billion to restaurants, and $15 billion to companies which were in trouble, right? The SVOG program, it was called, SVOG program. And, you know, that went to special venues, you know, people like museums and so forth. So another $76 billion. So you're looking at the total over the COVID recession here, COVID disbursements to small businesses of $1,061,000. $1 trillion, small businesses. But we still got almost a billion small businesses going under, 900,000, something like that. So 900,000 businesses didn't get what they needed, even though we spent $1 trillion for small business relief. What happened? A lot of them fell through the cracks. Well, you know, those that fell through the cracks, they're the ones who came out on the short end of all this, for sure. And even those who got some loans still lost an awful lot of money. You see, working for your income and selling things or services for your income is not the way to make money and get rich in this capitalist economy and society. You get rich from financial manipulations, from speculating in financial asset prices. That's how you get rich, you know. So what we see is a very lopsided picture, where nearly a million small businesses went under and many others experienced big losses, tightening their belts, take them a long time to recover. You've got workers who lost untold amounts of income and wages from layoff and partial recall. And then you got renters, right? What about the renters and the mortgage rent assistance and rent forbearance and mortgage forbearance, right, and student loan forbearance? All that forbeared payment, in other words, suspended payment, has to be repaid. Yeah, they're still on the hook. It's not as if we've given them grants that says, okay, you don't have to pay. What they owe keeps accumulating, has kept accumulating over the past year, and they're going to have to pay that at some point. Yeah. It's not like the small business loans, which can easily be converted to outright grants. You don't have to pay it back. No, no. You know, students and renters and households with mortgages have to pay it back. They just suspended it. That's all. See, if you're a business, you get the free money. You know, if you're not a business, you got to pay it back. At the end of last year, there was some statistic I read that about $70 billion was owed in back rent. $70 billion. And I don't know what it is here 6-7 months later, whether it's more or less, but you know, probably you know, somewhat more, a little bit. $70 billion. Back rent. Yeah. The original CARES Act, I think, provided $25 billion in rent assistance only. And that was used up, you know, during 2020 with, you know, the residual being $70 billion still owed. And then the American Rescue Plan, Biden's, you know, early March stimulus, provided, I think, another $52 billion in rental assistance, but only $47 billion has been paid. What's going on? Is this bureaucratic bungling that mainstream media would like you to think? Or is it a problem with the landlords themselves refusing to participate? I think it's significantly... partially, at least, the latter. You know, this $52 billion, you know, $47 not spent, is supposed to go directly to the landlords. Well, why don't they want rental assistance compensation from the government under this program? Well, they don't want it because there's strings attached. Just like big corporations didn't want to borrow the $1 trillion because there's strings attached. You know, the strings for corporate loans, big corporate loans that was offered to them was that they had to use it to keep their workers employed. In other words, they didn't want to do that. I mean, Boeing, for example, was in big trouble last year. They were in trouble going into the crisis, and then they're in big trouble. Last year, they needed $50 billion, they said. And the government said, okay, here's a loan, you know, if you want it, but you got to keep your workers employed with it. And they decided, Boeing decided, nah, we don't want the money. We're going to go raise corporate bonds with no strings attached. And they did that. At least $25 billion in corporate bonds were raised by Boeing. Instead of taking the loan from the government, you see. And that was replicated across the board in many places. The airlines got $52 billion, by the way, of subsidy money from the government. $52 billion. They're supposed to keep their workers employed. Some of them did not. They took the money anyway. $52 billion bailout last year. Went just to the airlines. What was it, half a dozen airline companies? Yeah, pretty generous. Pretty generous. Okay, so let's get back to rent and rental assistance program. You know, we had a moratorium on evictions last year that was extended several times, and it just got extended again. It was supposed to expire on July 31st, and they extended it another couple months. I think they extended it just 2 months here because it was really embarrassing that $47 billion in rental assistance hadn't been paid, and they want a couple more months to distribute that money. But they're having problems, I think, because a lot of landlords don't want the money. Well, why don't they want the money? Well, because it's got strings. Attached? Like what? It's only designed to cover 80% of the rents owned. You see, 80% of the back rent. Well, they want 100%. That's one reason. Another one reason why they're not cooperating, landlords. You see, to apply for rental assistance, both the renter and the landlord have to file separate reports, separate claims, say. And if the landlord doesn't file the claim, well, then, you know, the money doesn't go. So 80% of back pay is one reason why some of them aren't signing, right? Also, another string is they got to give up the right to collect all back payments in the future. In other words, the 20% that the renter still has to pay. Others simply want to sell or convert their rental units. They don't want to rent anymore. They want to sell because property prices are going through the roof. They want to sell or convert to condos or whatever, right? Much more profitable. That's another reason they don't want to participate in this program, right? And they want the right going in the future that they can evict these people anyway if they miss even 1 month of rent, if they're behind even 1 month. They'll evict them again. They'll take the money, but they want to evict these people again. In other words, we'll take the money and do what we're going to do anyway. Okay. So, you know, there's a real problem here, I think, with landlords not really wanting to participate in the program. And, of course, there's a difference between a landlord who rents out his one available family home. You know, maybe a relative had the will to them, and they're renting it out, you know, small renters, small landlords, and big companies like BlackRock, you know, that own millions now of rental units in the U.S., buying them up. You know, BlackRock, a private equity firm, shadow bank. So, you know, renters are taking it in the ear, too. They got this backlog they got to pay. The employers, I mean, the landlords don't want to take it. You know, they're on the hook for the full 100% now. And evictions, by the way, have been occurring, you know, for throughout the whole year and even last year, because all this moratorium on evictions is just for part of the rental units, 48 million rental units in the U.S., those that in some way got some federal subsidy or support or rules are the ones that the CDC and the federal government say, okay, we got to continue the moratorium. And by the way, there's only six states that have all their own state moratorium on evictions. I think California, New Jersey, New York, and I forget what the others are. They're not in the South or the Midwest. So, you know, the renters have not done well. Okay. And it hasn't hit the fan for those with their $1.8 trillion student loans. That's the latest figure I saw. Debt, student loan debt, $1.8 trillion. Right? There's been a forbearance. In other words, you don't have to pay while it's still in forbearance. That'll end next January. But when you do, it's being tacked on to the back of it. You're going to still owe that, and you're going to owe interest on the interest you didn't pay, as well as the principal you didn't pay. You know, student loan debt numbers are going to jump, or the loans will be extended. That's a damper on consumption. Oh, you know, and the position of the Democrats and Biden during the election was, okay, we're going to expunge some of that student debt. Bernie Sanders said $50,000, and Biden said, oh, $10,000. But they're not going to do anything. There's not going to be any debt relief for student loans. Even Nancy Pelosi just came out and said, no, we're not going to, expunge any student loans. No relief on student loans, so it's dead. By the way, she had always been in favor of student loan relief, but all of a sudden she turned on it after she talked to her big campaign contributors, the Swig family here, billionaires, San Francisco billionaires. She's flipped on that student loan. So forget that. Students aren't going to get any relief under this Democratic administration, even though they were promised, right, in campaigns. Okay, so, students aren't getting any relief. They're going to be burdened with even more payments here soon. The renters, I don't know if they're going to distribute $47 billion in 2 months. We'll see. I doubt it. They're not getting any relief. They're still going to start getting even more evicted. Even the federal moratorium is going to be lifted here in a couple months. They won't extend it any further. Because the Supreme Court has come out against the administration for one reason and said that, it's unconstitutional for the executive branch to extend the evictions moratorium. What the hell are they saying? He's appointed for life. Most of them right-wingers saying it's unconstitutional. They can stop anything by saying it's unconstitutional. Did they ever have the right to declare under the Constitution laws unconstitutional? No. Read the Constitution. Read the proceedings of the Constitutional Convention, 1787. There's no Supreme Court. And there's especially no acknowledgement that the Supreme Court has the right to declare laws passed by the elected people, representatives of the people, unconstitutional. It doesn't exist. The Supreme Court is not a co-equal branch of government in the Constitution. Well, how did the hell did it get that way? How did they get the right to declare anything unconstitutional? 14 unelected, life-appointed rich popes. How did they get that? They simply usurped it. When we had our first political revolution called the Jeffersonian Revolution in 1800, where Jefferson defeated John Adams, who was the president of business interests and speculators, defeated him. What Adams did, President Adams did before he left office, was he appointed his Secretary of State, John Marshall, as the chief judge of the Supreme Court to get one of his guys in on the ground in the Jefferson administration, to try to wreck the legislation that was coming, the popular legislation. And Marshall's the guy who a few years later said, we have the right to declare something unconstitutional. He usurped that problem, that power. Now, they didn't really exercise that until after the Civil War. Then they really, the Supreme Court, began to exercise the unconstitutionality to hold back democracy, you see. That's what it's all about. At the same time, Supreme Court rules, I think in 1877, that corporations are persons and are protected by the Bill of Rights. And then, of course, the Supreme Court we have in 2010 in the Citizens United decision says, they're persons and they got free speech. And you know what? Spending money is free speech by corporation people. Yeah, that's how we get the Citizens United. And the Supreme Court usurped that power. It's not in the Constitution. The whole court system was created by Congress, including the Supreme Court. So all of its Supreme Court authority that it's usurped derives from Congress. Congress could change it at any time. But they don't want it. That's one of the big checks, you see, on the people, on democracy. They want to keep it that way, just like they want to keep the filibuster, you know. They want to keep it. That's a big check, you know, and there's other checks. You know, all this nonsense about checks and balances is really checks on the people so that you can keep an imbalance of power in the hands of the wealthy few. That's what checks and balances is about. Yeah, and the Supreme Court, to continue the digression, has been running amok, you know, in the last couple of decades. They selected George W. Bush. They had no authority to do that as president in 2000. Bush versus Gore decision. Stop the count. Stop the vote count in Florida. Give it to Bush. Man, no authority there. That should have gone to the House of Representatives to decide. But the Supreme Court took it. They have no right, no authority to do that, but they did anyway. And then they played a big role in endorsing gerrymandering going on in state legislatures and the U.S. House of Representatives. They've endorsed it, so it's okay. Do whatever they want. And that's why you got the red states so powerful. There's more red states than blue states. Blue states have more population, more red states. By gerrymandering, you know, there's only 50 or so houses in the House of Representatives that are really contestable in every election. All the rest are safely gerrymandered in either of the two parties. You know, that's the result of gerrymandering going on at state legislatures and the endorsing of the whole process by the Supreme Court and decisions. And now we got all these voter suppression laws, and that's being endorsed by the Supreme Court as well. Yeah. Yeah, Supreme Court is a break on democracy. They're rolling democracy back, no doubt. Okay. Well, that's all part of, to bring it back, part of what's going on with the renters. So you see, they can't continue the eviction because the Supreme Court, a moratorium on evictions, the Supreme Court says, no, you can't do that. You're not allowed to do that. Well, who the hell are they? Where's that right to declare anything unconstitutional that elected representatives of the people decide? All right. So renters are taking it in the air. Small businesses, almost a million of them, have gone out of business despite the $1 trillion being allocated. It's not really getting to a lot of them. Workers took it in the air. Students will take it in the air pretty soon here. Well, those are the folks who haven't benefited from what's going on. It's part of the creeping austerity that's beginning to emerge, you know. During a big crisis, they throw some money to keep people placated. But then they figure out a way of taking it back pretty damn quick. You know, that's what Obama did, $787 billion in 2009 to stimulate the economy, and then he agrees with the Republicans in 2011 to take $1.5 trillion back. That's austerity. Well, we're doing the same thing now. We're taking back. We're ending unemployment benefits. We're ending rent assistance. We're ending small business assistance. But we're continuing the flow of free money to the bankers and the big corporations at a rate of $120 billion a month. Free money. Yeah, that's the balance sheet here of who gained and who's losing from this COVID recession. I'm out.